In the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today, we're going to delve into one of the mysteries of the Old Testament. A basic mystery about the book of Esther. Not so much about Esther itself, but the first question we're going to deal with as we talk about Esther, the 24th day of May is the day where the church remembers Esther as an Old Testament saint. Why is this book in the Old Testament? It does not mention God, although if one reads it, it's hard to read it as nothing, as something other than a God's providential work. But why is it there? We're going to be talking about that initially with Dr. Andrew Steinman here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. as we discuss Esther and the Book of Esther. Dr. Andrew Steinman is Associate Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University in River Forest, Illinois. He'll join us here in just a moment. When we've concluded our conversation on Esther with Dr. Steinman, open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll hear two cuts from George W. Bush last night. He addressed the War College, I believe, and it was a nationally televised address as well, although I noticed that Fox was still carrying that beauty pageant that creeps me out, the swan, with all the women who've been made over. Ugh, I just get the chills. But the president had a few things to say last night. Among them, he said, as he talked about terrorists, none of the things that the terrorists are doing or planning to do are an expression of religion. We'll hear from him and get your reaction during open lines in the latter part of this hour. In the 4 o'clock hour, we'll start out talking about 8th century scholar and theologian Bede the Venerable. Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, will be our guest. Then we'll be talking with Suzanne Venker, author of 7 Myths of Working Mothers, picking up on part 2 of that 7-part daily series on these myths. We'll talk about the myth that I just couldn't stay home full-time. I don't think I could do that. That's the myth we'll deal with today. And then, in the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc., we'll talk about the Gandhi legacy in India that comes to the fore, because, of course, in the recent elections in India, a Gandhi has refused the prime ministership. That family has, in one form or another, ruled India since 1947. We'll talk about it with Dr. Victor Raj of Concordia Seminary in the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Andrew Steinman is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He joins us to talk about Esther here on the day after the church remembers Esther as an Old Testament saint. He's Associate Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University in River Forest, Illinois. Dr. Steinman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be back.
Let's clear out the question, first of all. If the Book of Esther, as it seems, does not mention God explicitly, how is it that it comes to be in the Old Testament canon?
Well, I think you're right that in your introduction, you said, you know, it does kind of hint at God all along anyway. I think it comes to be in the Old Testament precisely because it doesn't mention God. It's a book that tells about how God's people can serve him without being overtly religious in everything that they do. And so I think that it, in a way, shows us how we can cope with a very secular world without having to use God talk every second of every day.
At the same time, can one rightly understand the story that's put forth in the Book of Esther if one reads it purely as a document of secular history?
No, you can't get it if you just read it as a secular history. I think the point is that the author wants you to pick up the clues that God is in control of things here. And everything that happens in Esther is under his guidance and for the benefit of his people.
What do we know about the authorship, the occasion, the date of this book of Esther?
Well, we don't know the exact date of the authorship. It had to have been written some years after the events of Esther. And the reason I can say that is because at the end of the book, it looks back on the Feast of Purim, which is initiated in Esther, and it looks back on that apparently from some distance. So it might be, my guess is, as up to 100 years after the time it was written, now, the time the events happen. Now, the events happen around 460 B.C. I would think that it was probably written down within 25 years of that, but I can't prove it. I would think anything a date after 360 is way too late, considering the style of the Hebrew.
And is the author of Esther anonymous?
He doesn't identify himself. Some people have proposed that Mordecai, one of the major persons in the book, wrote the book some years later, looking back on it, and I suppose that's a possibility. But he doesn't identify himself, so we can't be 100% certain of who wrote it.
Okay, tell us about what is the state of God's people. Where does this fall in the timeline of the Old Testament, so that we can get kind of a historical context for the story of Esther?
Okay, this is one of the last books of the Old Testament. It takes place after the Babylonian captivity. Many of the Jews had already returned to Babylon, from Babylon to Jerusalem. And some of them stayed behind in places like Babylon and spread even further east into Persia, where Esther takes place. It's roughly contemporary with many of the events in Ezra and Nehemiah. And so Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther are all grouped together, of course, in our canon, and there's a good reason for that. Whereas Ezra and Nehemiah are taking place in Jerusalem, on the other side of the ancient Near East, Esther's taking place in Persia, far to the east of that, about the same time as those same events.
So would we be talking modern-day Iraq, Iran?
Yeah, especially Iran.
So really far east.
Yes.
We're nearly to to India thereabouts.
Yeah, we're Persia bordered on the classical India, which included Pakistan and part of Afghanistan. So we're pretty far east here.
How do Esther and Mordecai, the two Jews, as they're called, I think for the only time in the Old Testament, they're actually called Jews rather than Hebrews or Israelites or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
How do they come to find themselves here in the court of the Persian dynasty?
Well, we don't know exactly how they got to the Persian court, but my guess is that during the Babylonian captivity, as many Jews prospered, they spread out in the ancient Near East, and some of them going as far east as the Persian capital of Susa. And apparently we find when the book opens up that Mordecai, who raised Esther, he wasn't his father, but he raised her, she was a relative and had lost her parents. We find that Mordecai is a fairly important man in the Persian court. The Persians were fairly open to having non-Persians serve in the government, as long as, of course, that the Persians kept ultimate control. And we find that Mordecai is a fairly prominent man. He sits in the king's gate, which means that he serves in the king's court. Only the people that were in his administration could do that. So somehow, over the years since the Babylonian captivity, Mordecai came to be a prominent man and in the service of the Persian king.
Tell us the story that the book of Esther brings us.
Well, Esther starts out with the king Xerxes. In many Bibles, he's called Ahasuerus, but we know him probably best from the Greek histories of Persia as Xerxes. And Xerxes throws this banquet in which he is entertaining all of his nobles. And during that time, he's showing off his great wealth. And this banquet lasts for quite a long time. We're told 180 days, so this is no small banquet. And the wine flows freely. And at some point, Xerxes decides to show off his queen. Her name is Vashti. And he orders her to come in so that everyone can see her beauty and what a beautiful woman that he married. And she refuses to do it. And in some ways, you have to admire her, that she doesn't want to be treated like just a piece of property, but like a human being. But at any rate, she refuses to come, and this sends Xerxes and his advisors into a little bit of a quandary, because they're afraid that if the queen can refuse to obey the king, then other wives might refuse to obey their husbands, and so they decide to ask the king to issue a decree that all women must obey their husbands, and it's decided that Vashti will no longer be queen. Now, this doesn't mean that Xerxes is going to get a divorce. He has more than one wife. The queen is just the favored wife. But she will no longer be the favored wife. And so after all this calms down, Xerxes decides that he needs a new queen. But he's not going to choose one of his present wives. He is going to search for a new wife. And so we're told about the search. They assemble these eligible young women for Xerxes to see, and Esther is one of these young women. She's brought into the court, and along with the other women, she is going to spend one night with the king, and whichever one pleases him best will be chosen queen. And it turns out that Esther, who's a very smart gal because she gets some very good advice before she goes to see the king as to what kinds of things he prefers, what his personality is like, and so forth, she ends up being the one chosen. Esther is made queen. About the same time, we find out that Mordecai, who is serving in the king's gate, uncovers a plot where Xerxes is going to be assassinated, and he reports it to Esther, who reports it to Xerxes, and the plot is foiled, and the king's life is saved. So we find, you know, both Esther now and Mordecai very prominent in the king's court. But right away, the book shifts to a man named Haman. It seems that Haman, who's kind of Xerxes' prime minister, is a very vain man, and we find out that Haman gets very upset at Mordecai because everybody else will bow and scrape to Haman because he is the prime minister, but Mordecai won't. Mordecai the Jew won't bow to Haman, and so he comes up with a plot to have all the Jews killed. It wasn't good enough for him just to kill Mordecai. He decided he had to kill all the Jews. And so he goes to the king, says, there's this problem people that you have in your realm, and I will pay you money even if you'll let me have them executed all. The king says, well, if they're that much of a problem, and he doesn't find out who these people are, he just trusts Haman. So he says, if they're that much of a problem, you don't have to pay me any money. You can just go ahead and do this. And so Haman issues a decree in the king's name that on a certain date, all the Jews are going to be killed. Anyone who wants to can kill the Jews in the Persian Empire, which would include all the Jews back in Jerusalem, because the Persians have this huge empire, and it includes Jerusalem. Well, Haman wants to do this, but he doesn't know what date to do it on. And so he decides, like a lot of people in the Old Testament, to cast lots. And we find out that the lot falls on a day almost a year away. And here's where we see how God is in control. Because, of course, although Haman thinks he's doing things randomly by casting lots and finding the best day that he thinks his gods will favor the killing of the Jews, we know that the God is in charge of this. And so it falls almost a year away. Mordecai finds out about it. He goes into mourning. He, as many Jews did in the ancient times, and some still today, he tore his clothes, he threw ashes on his head, he dressed in sackcloth because of this decree. Esther finds out about it. She tries to cheer him up, get him to dress in better clothes, and she doesn't know why this is going on. And finally, he tells her. Now, keep in mind that when Esther became queen, Mordecai had told her not to tell the king that she was Jewish in case she might be discriminated against, I guess. And so she hasn't told the king. Now he says, you're going to have to tell the king. You're going to have to expose this plot. And he says to her, if you don't realize that help for the Jews will come from somewhere. Here's the strongest hint about God in the entire book. When he says to her, help for the Jews will come from somewhere, you and your father's family, Mordecai tells her, may be wiped out, but God, he is implying, will take care of his people. Well, he persuades Esther, and she holds two banquets for the king, and it's at the second one she finally tells him. Now, Haman had, in the meantime, put up a pole that he wanted to kill Mordecai on and then hang his dead body on. And in the meantime, Haman's been kind of humiliated in a way because the king had a sleepless night, and when he couldn't get to sleep, they got the royal records out and read them to him. You know, it's kind of like reading the congressional record to somebody. What better way to get him to sleep? And so they read this kind of boring record to him in a sleepless night, and it just so happens, and here again we get a hint of God's control, that they open up to the story of how the king's life was saved with this plot we talked about earlier. And the king had said, what did I do for the guy who did this and saved my life? And they say, the record doesn't say you did anything. And so he says, I've got to do something for this guy. And so the next morning when Haman came in for his morning meeting with the king says, I'd like to do something for somebody I'm pleased with. And Haman, who's always a little bit too full of himself, thought, well, who could it be but me? And so he wanted some royal recognition, and he said, put the person on a royal horse and put royal robes on him and parade him through the capital with people running in front of him saying, this is a man that the king honors. Well, Haman thinks that's going to happen to him, but immediately the king says, go do that for Mordecai. So Haman had to do that for Mordecai immediately before the second banquet that Esther is throwing for the king. And so he does that. He goes home. He tells his wife. His wife tells him, you better watch out for this guy Mordecai if this is what happened today. And immediately the king's couriers come along and say, it's time for the banquet, time to go. And so he goes to the banquet, the second banquet that Esther throws for the king. And the king says, okay, please tell me why we're having this banquet. What is it that you want to bring up? And Esther finally says, well, if it was just about me, I wouldn't bring it up, but it's about my entire people. There's been a plot to kill my entire people, and that would also endanger me. Well, Xerxes gets really mad at this point. Anybody that would endanger his queen, obviously he's going to be upset about, and he says, well, who is the person who did this? And she points at Haman and said, this is the guy. And now it comes out, Haman's plot. Well, the king leaves the room, and he's so upset, and I guess he's in a rage, and Haman stays behind with Esther, and he's pleading for his life. Now, keep in mind, in banquets in the ancient world, they didn't sit at a table with chairs. They reclined on couches. So Haman's over at Esther's couch, pleading because he knows his life is in the balance, and the king comes back in, and what he sees, he thinks, is Haman molesting his wife. And so he has him drug out, he has him executed, and he has his dead body put up on the pole that Haman had put up for Mordecai. Well, we're almost done with the story, but we're not out of the woods yet, because the Persians had a custom. It's mentioned in the book of Esther, and it's also mentioned in the book of Daniel. When the king passes a decree, or somebody with the king's authority passes a decree, it can't be taken back. So what are we going to do? Because all the Jews could be killed. Well, Haman is gone as prime minister, and the king elevates Mordecai to be prime minister. And Mordecai issues a decree in the king's name that the Jews will be allowed to defend themselves, and even with a preemptive strike the day before. Remember, they've got several months to go yet before this decree comes. Well, we're told that fear of all people falls on the Jews, and the Jews pretty much don't have to defend themselves. There's some sporadic, I guess, from the way the book tells it, some sporadic defense that they have to do. But they defend themselves. And Mordecai also decrees that the Jews every year should celebrate a feast on that day. And they call the Feast of Purim, which is kind of a combination Persian-Hebrew word, which means lots. You'll remember Haman threw the lot to determine the day. Well, they call this feast the Feast of Purim or the Feast of Lots. It usually occurs in January or February, and Jews around the world still celebrate it to this day. And the book ends with Mordecai as prime minister Xerxes is still king of this vast empire, and of course the Jews have been saved from this great tragedy of genocide against all of them. So that's kind of the book in a nutshell.
With only a few minutes here before we have to wrap up our conversation, Dr. Steinman, the quintessential question of the Old Testament, regardless of what book we're looking at, is wherein do we find Christ in this? And in a book that doesn't even mention God explicitly, but of course has him acting in the background as the unseen character, where is Christ in the book of Esther?
Well, I think, again, like God in general, Christ is only hinted at here. And I think in some ways it's hinted at in that just as God arranged all the events in Esther to happen at just the right time, after all these, the lot fell, you know, to give him almost a year's lead time to undo this plot, so also in just the right time, God sent his son into the world. God arranged events so that it was the perfect time for his son to come into the world. And I think that's one hint of Christ in the book. We might see Mordecai and his defense for the people as kind of a prefiguration of Christ in a way, although I think that's a bigger leap. I think the real kind of way to see it is just as God is in control behind the scenes of all the events of Esther, so he was in control behind the scenes to make sure that just the right people, the Romans, were in charge at just the right time, and that his son was born in just the right place to do what had to be done to save not just the Jewish people, but all people.
What about, with only a minute, what about Esther? She puts her life on the line, admitting that she is a Jew before a king who'd already given an edict to kill all the Jews. Does she in some way prefigure the self-sacrifice, at least potentially, of
Jesus
Christ?
Yes, I think so. Her willingness to put her life on the line, I think in a way shows us kind of a prefiguring of Christ, who is, of course, willing to put his life on the line in a much greater way for us.
Dr. Andrew Steinman, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc., and thank you for taking us through the life of Esther as presented to us in the Old Testament, Old Testament saint.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is Associate Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University in River Forest, Illinois. Well, maybe it is just that. God working together all things for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. God working all of history, even the workings of the inner court of a Persian emperor 500 years before Christ, to lay the foundation for not only the salvation of his people so that they are not wiped out in a genocide, but the salvation of his people so that through those people might come a Savior for all people everywhere. God is always in the business of saving his people. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. Of course, the president last night gave a nationally televised address. We'll hear a little bit of what he had to say about terrorism and Islam and get your reaction during open lines right after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What does it mean to be a Lutheran? Well, being a Lutheran is truly all about Jesus. The central teachings of the Lutheran faith are the central teachings of Holy Scripture. Jesus is always and only the center of all Christian teaching. Being a Lutheran is truly all about Jesus because Holy Scripture is truly all about Jesus. Hi, I'm Todd Wilkin. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is called Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by regular guest Daniel Preuss. You can order Why I Am a Lutheran by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. There you'll find information on our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by Daniel Preuss.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on finding Christians who will serve with passion and purpose by teaching overseas. In Central Asia, high school and university level students are eager to have Americans teach them business or conversational English. Sharing your knowledge of those subjects allows you to let your care for others shine while making lifelong friends. The mission agency, teachoverseas.org, provides all the training, so you don't even need a teaching degree. Officials in Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan want qualified teachers who will instruct the students professionally, yet take a personal interest in them. Christians are needed to fill the many teaching positions that are now available. Pray the people who love Christ will respond and serve with purpose and passion by teaching overseas in Central Asia and in other regions. Get more information by logging on to the website teachoverseas.org. That's teachoverseas.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Columnist Eleanor Markgraf wrote about a recent bout she had with pneumonia. Bowing to her doctor's orders to stay home, she didn't feel good enough to read the book she wanted to read. And she added, other books seem senseless wastes of time. I can't think for a minute why I planned to read the letters from Harry Truman to his wife, Bess. Initially, Harry seemed like a fine guy, concerned and doting toward his wife and child. But after a couple hundred letters, I started feeling downright sorry for Bess. Ha ha! When I discovered Diane had kept all the letters I wrote to her when we were dating, I felt sorry for her and embarrassed by my cloddish self. We laughed about it, that bundle of boring letters. No one has ever described me as romantic, but still she kept the letters. Maybe that's because she saw something in our relationship, something that she has nourished for over 30 years. I thank heaven for her patience, waiting as she has for me to realize what a wonderful thing our long-worked-at marriage is. Wrote Mrs. Markgraf, why she saved the darn things is beyond me. I think the answer is love, and most men are slow understanding it.
When you think about the theology of glory, you may think that this is the theology that looks to God as a glorious human being, that He is the one who has glory. And the theology of the cross is where you got to do a lot of sacrifices and crucifying yourself in order to get to heaven. Well, those are almost the exact opposites of what the theology of glory means and the theology of the cross.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Open lines for the remainder of this hour. That's 25 minutes for your questions and your comments, anything that you'd like to talk about. That's how open lines works. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Of course, we just got finished with the conversation with Dr. Andrew Steinman on the Book of Esther. If you have a question there, that is certainly fair game as well. We're going to hear in a moment from President George W. Bush, who addressed the nation last night, a nationally televised address from the War College. And he was very clear in his goal of what he wanted to do in this speech. He wanted to lay out for the American people, and he said also the Iraqi people, his kind of 5 points to clarify the strategy, the direction, the intention of the war with Iraq, and basically to try and demonstrate from his perspective, we're on track and this is what we're doing and everything's going according to plan, and there is a plan. I'm not so interested at this moment in the politics of that particular speech. I am interested in two things that the president had to say at the end of this speech when he was talking about our enemy, and he's talking about worldwide terrorism. But if we're really honest about it, we're not just talking about worldwide terrorism. At the moment, we're talking about Islamic terrorism. And he has, we'll hear it in just a moment, a rather lengthy description of our enemy. And he ends this in a very curious way by saying something that he said before. The president has said this before. Now, remember right around 9/11, when the Islam question was raised with the president, he said Islam is a religion of peace. And he was castigated by people on the right and a few, maybe even a few on the left. Didn't play well with Christian conservatives who knew better at least in terms of Islam's theology. The president hasn't said that in a long, long time. What he is saying, something more subtle. He'll say it again here in this speech, and we'll hear it in just a moment. I'd like your reaction as we listen to what the president had to say. And there's a second thing that he had to say. He actually ended his speech this way. His optimism for the Muslim world. Now, you can't fault a guy for being optimistic, but it raises a question, I think, the question. And after we've heard from the president and your reaction, as time permits, I've got an opinion piece from Baptist Press. Basil Shelton has asked the question, can democracy flourish in a Muslim society? I want you to listen to the president. Ask yourself this basic question, that can democracy flourish in a Muslim society? But also this, is the president being unrealistic? Is he discounting the question of Islam from foreign affairs and from his picture, rather rosy picture, of the future for the Muslim world? Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here's George W. Bush from last night's speech before the War College, nationally televised, near the end of the speech, where he talks about our enemy and what motivates our enemy, the terrorist.
Our terrorist enemies have a vision that guides and explains all their varied acts of murder. They seek to impose Taliban-like rule, country by country, across the greater Middle East. They seek the total control of every person and mind and soul. A harsh society in which women are voiceless and brutalized. They seek bases of operation to train more killers and export more violence. They commit dramatic acts of murder to shock, frighten, and demoralize civilized nations, hoping we will retreat from the world and give them free rein. They seek weapons of mass destruction to impose their will through blackmail and catastrophic attacks. None of this is the expression of a religion. It is a totalitarian political ideology pursued with consuming zeal and without conscience.
That's President George W. Bush. He says none of the things that our terrorist enemies are planning to do or doing are an expression of a religion. It is a totalitarian political ideology. Is that true? He says that none of the things that our terrorist enemies are planning to do, and he has the long list there, and who can argue with the list? It's been played out for us in country after country. He says none of this is an expression of a religion. It's a totalitarian political ideology. Is that what really moves the terrorists? Merely a political ideology? Yes, they're totalitarian. Yes, they have their political ramifications to it. But would they have that political ideology apart from their religion? Can the president really say that none of this that we see from our terrorist enemies is an expression of a religion? Now, he's gone from saying Islam is a religion of peace to saying this, which he said before. In fact, in his last major address, before his press conference a couple months back, from the White House, he said, again talking about the terrorists, he said, in effect, these people are not motivated by a religion, but by a totalitarian political ideology, pursued with consuming zeal and without conscience. Is the president being realistic about Islam? And if he isn't, what are the consequences here? Can you afford to say, okay, these people are Muslims and they're terrorists, and I can separate the two, and I can take the religion question and just lay it aside? I know why you would want to do that. And I know that there are those among the president's advisors who feel comfortable doing that. Can you really do that? Can you say of our terrorist enemies that what they do and what they plan to do is not an expression of a religion, but just their political ideology? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. That's one of the things that struck me when I heard the president speak last night. Among all the things that I found encouraging about what he had to say. This one raised a red flag with me. And it's not a little red flag. It's a huge red flag. If what motivates our terrorist enemies is in fact Islam, if they are acting in accord with their religion, can we afford to act as though they're not? Can we afford to plan as though they're not? Can we ignore the Islam question? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, here's something else the president had to say just a few minutes after that, near the very end of the speech. If you were still with him at this point, he is talking about his hopes for the future, his hopes for, well, not only for the war with Iraq, but for the entire future of the Middle East. He starts talking about the greater Middle East, and this is what he has to say.
We believe it is a tragedy of history that in the Middle East, which gave the world great gifts of law and science and faith, so many have been held back by lawless tyranny and fanaticism. We believe that when all Middle Eastern peoples are finally allowed to live and think and work and worship as free men and women, they will reclaim the greatness of their own heritage. And when that day comes, the bitterness and burning hatreds that feed terrorism will fade and die away.
There again, President George W. Bush addressing the nation last night. Now, he says, when all Middle Eastern peoples are finally allowed to live and think and work and worship as free men and women, is that going to happen with Islam as part of the equation? Will it? Will Islam, the religion of these people, permit some sort of a political system that will allow people to live and work and think and worship as free men and women? Will, as the president said, the bitterness and burning hatreds that feed terrorism fade and die away if democracy flourishes somehow in the Middle East? I want to hear from you. Do you think the president has underestimated Islam? 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. I don't want to overstate my case here, folks, but this is the question. If you're going to formulate a foreign policy, you have to take everything into account. You have to look at your enemy and understand your enemy from top to bottom, right? What if we would have gone and pursued our conflict with the Nazis and said, "Now look, they're crazy ideas about the superiority of the race. That's not really relevant to the issue. We'll just kind of lay that aside. They do have a totalitarian political ideology. And that's what motivates them. But we're going to take this whole notion, this quasi-early German pagan notion that Hitler had adopted, a religious notion. He was not a Christian man. He was not encouraging the German nation to return to its Christian roots. He was through National Socialism, he was encouraging the German nation, he was pursuing a line with the German nation to return them to their pagan roots and to German superiority based on pagan ideals. Had we said that, you know, these pagan ideals, they're not relevant to the question. How different would we have dealt with the Nazi threat? Now, can we afford, if it is true that Islam does fuel the terrorist, and not just crazy ideas that he might have apart from his religion, if that is true, can we afford to ignore it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This Islam question is the question. It is. And it's not going to go away tomorrow. Dennis is calling from his car. He's first up. Dennis, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Pastor Todd. How are you today?
Very well.
And thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'd like to interject some ideas, you know, into your conversation. I think that perhaps if more moderate views and voices within the Islamic community were allowed to surface and to be heard, I think they may be able to, I suppose, differentiate between the more fanatical elements and take power, so to speak. What they've done in Turkey is that they've separated the theocratic political principles of Islam and they've introduced more democratic principles. So there is, in effect, a separation of church and state to a certain degree within Turkey. Now, they've been the only successful country, as far as I know, Islamic country, to be able to do that. Saudi Arabia, the United States' major ally in the Middle East, they have been unable to do that.
Now, let's talk about Turkey for a second, Dennis, because okay. that, I think, is probably what is in the back of the president's mind when he talks about democracy, freedom of thinking, working, living, and worshiping, flourishing in the greater Middle East. That's probably what it is in his mind.
Okay.
But Turkey is what it is today because what it was before was a secularist nation, right?
Well, the Ottoman Empire was actually, more of a military empire than a religious one. They were overthrown, I believe it was in, 1917, 1918, with the overthrow of the Turks, with that revolution, and the British helped overthrow that empire, and then they occupied that nation, and then those Western ideas about democracy and government were actually imposed upon them.
But Ataturk was a secularist, correct, a generation ago.
They still had Islamic roots. They still, practiced Islam, but not as devoutly, I suppose, as the Saudis or the Shias or the Sunnis. So
this is what we're faced with, and I don't disagree with you that it can be done, but can it be done without? Can it be done? It's the chicken and egg question, Dennis. I look at it this way.
Okay.
In order to have democracy among Muslims, then do Muslims have to cease to be essentially Islamic before, and then democracy can take hold, and then in this kind of compromised Islam, in this kind of atmosphere, then democracy can take hold, and you can have a secular state.
They're going to have to do is not cease to be Islamic, but cease to be theocratic, and they're going to have to basically wrest the reins of authority from the religious leaders and put that more within the members of their community. And I don't know, they do that here in the United States because they're willing to do that, I believe, to become acculturated into our country. However, they don't have the pressure to do that within their own countries because the religious leaders still maintain a tremendous sway over their people.
Well, okay, two questions before I let you go. First of all, do you believe that Islam is essentially theocratic? That is, part and parcel of Islam is a theocratic worldview.
I guess the more orthodox form of Islam is absolutely a theocratic worldview. And I think that that's prevalent in the Middle Eastern countries that have Islam as its government, so to speak.
One more question, then.
Okay.
The Turkish prime minister right now is a practicing Muslim. Realistically, where do you think Turkey will be 20 years from now?
Probably a whole lot more Western than it is right now.
Dennis, thank you for your call.
Okay. Right.
One would hope, along with the president, such a thing would happen. The question that I admire the president's optimism, but the question that he has yet to seem to struggle with or to answer, well, yes, he has answered it. The way he's answered it is, Islam, he's basically still saying Islam is a religion of peace. Once you strip away all the terrorist things that accrue to it, more often than not, it is not essentially theocratic. It's not essentially about Sharia law. It's not essentially about blurring the distinction between church and state. It is essentially about peace, and it can work with democracy. That's how the president has decided to answer this question. Has he answered it correctly? Do you see the what a miscalculation it could be if his answer to that question is not right? Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, a common guest on our program, said on this program that you will find some freedoms in some of the major cities in Turkey. However, and he knows whereof he speaks, in the bush, in the hinterlands, you still find Sharia law. Where the government doesn't have immediate control over the institutions and the infrastructure, Sharia law resurfaces. Now, is that because they're still working out the kinks, or is that because when Islam is practiced according to the Quran and the Hadith, you end up with a society that wherein democracy cannot flourish? I know that it's popular to think that we can somehow separate. You know, the Roman Catholics are doing this now. I can somehow separate my religious views from my political views. I can somehow separate what I believe essentially as a believer, whatever that is, a believer in Allah, a believer in Jesus Christ. I can somehow take that and compartmentalize it from my civic views, my political views. We have 1 billion Muslims. I think the force of numbers is going to answer this question eventually. It's not going to be theory. It's not going to be whether we believe that democracy can flourish. The force of numbers is going to answer this question. Given the fact that the majority of those 1 billion Muslims live in Muslim states with one form or another of Sharia law, and the very minuscule minority of those 1 billion Muslims live in Western states or westernized states like Turkey, where there is some form of democracy, freedom of religion, of work, of life, of thought, of worship, of all the other freedoms in Western society. It may not matter how you answer this question in the long run. I mean, it may all be very theoretical. Basil Shelton has written most recently, this is as of yesterday, in the first person column for Baptist Press. This is an opinion piece. He asks the question in the headline, "Can democracy flourish in a Muslim society?" Here's a bit of what he had to say. At an Arab League summit in Tunisia, May 22nd and 23rd, that was this last weekend, folks, Arab heads of state voted to lead their countries toward democracy and human rights. The Tunis Declaration is the League's first pledge to promote Western-style special and political reforms among its 22 member states, which includes some of the most repressive governments in the world. Now, that's another way of saying which includes many Islamic states. No issue in the Arab world could be more divisive. Cooperating with Americans and the British, who are promoting democracy in the region, could lead to economic development and greater prosperity. But that taps into Arab anger over Palestinian and Iraq situations and immediately puts an Arab leader in the crosshairs of a militant Islam that sees the West as the great Satan. Leaders of 5 Arab states reportedly have been invited to present the League's 13-point plan to the Group of 8 summit of major industrial countries in June, when the United States will introduce its own blueprint for Arab reform called the Greater Middle East Initiative. I think we heard a bit of that, a preview of that last night from the president. While an Arab League spokesman hailed their declaration as historic, human rights activists doubted Arab leaders would follow through with their promises. The document includes no plan for concrete action or mechanism for requiring Arab states to cooperate, which raises the question, says Shelton, can democracy and human rights flourish in a Muslim society? Not in a society that contains Muslims, but in a society that is overwhelmingly Muslim. If so, he says, there are a few examples. Most Arab governments are dictatorships whose citizens know nothing of either democracy or human rights. The few that do allow some measure of democratic freedom and human rights, yet keep a tight rein on Muslim teachers. In other words, in order to allow human rights and democracy to flourish in their nations, as Dennis so rightly pointed out, they have to keep the Muslim teachers under their thumb. Because if the Muslim teachers are given their way, what they preach from the mosque ends up undermining democracy. The countries in which Islamic authorities exercise political power, that is, when the clergy exercise political power in Islamic countries, like the Taliban did in Afghanistan, they are notorious violators of fundamental human rights. You see, this isn't a question that only occupies our president, that only has to do with our foreign policy. This is the question of the Middle East. Everybody says it's about oil. It isn't about oil. It's about religion. It's about Islam. This is what I think I find disconcerting when I hear President George W. Bush say that none of these things that our terrorist enemies, have planned or have done are an expression of a religion. It's just a totalitarian political ideology. Zealous? Pursued without conscience. But that's all it is, political ideology. When I hear him opine optimistically about a day coming when the burning bitterness and hatreds that feed terrorism fading and dying away if we can just get democracy in place in these countries, I believe it begs a question. It leaves a question unanswered. The question raised by Shelton, can democracy flourish in a Muslim society? Trying to understand the greater Middle East, if you have said before you begin the conversation that the religion practiced by the 1 billion inhabitants therein and elsewhere in the world, there are a lot of Muslims who also live in Indonesia too, by the way, who are not Arabs. They practice the same religion with many of the same results. Trying to have that conversation where from before you even start talking about it, you say, but Islam is a religion essentially of peace, and it's not a factor in how we're going to pursue peace in this region, is ill-conceived. In fact, one other thing before we go, hear from Shelton's piece. He says, the Institute for the Secularization of Islamic Society argues that Islam is inherently hostile to pluralistic democracy and the rights of minorities. The Quran, for example, not only allows Muslims to own slaves, but also allows masters to use their female slaves sexually, even if the slaves are married. Islam's Sharia law is neither impartial nor fair, points out the same Institute for the Secularization of Islamic Society. These are Muslims who want to secularize Islamic society because they see that their religion, these are liberal Muslims, they see that their religion needs secularization. For example, a Muslim may enter a home of a non-Muslim and rob him with impunity because that's according to Sharia law. Because Islamic law forbids non-Muslim testimony against a Muslim, the non-Muslim has no legal recourse. Now, one might say, well, is Christianity compatible with democracy? So far, so good. You see, Christianity is different because it does recognize a difference between the church and the state. Christianity can flourish even under, say, a dictatorship or an atheistic communistic system. Are the Christians happy there? Not necessarily. Are they well taken care of? No. But the faith remains untouched because the faith has nothing to do with who's in charge. Maybe with Islam, it has everything to do with who is in charge. We'll be right back for the second hour of Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.